Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we've got Tim Bouverie talking about appeasing Hitler.
Thank you to Bryanston for sponsoring this. I can't claim in any way to have been a particularly distinguished pupil, but I think I had improved a tiny bit since my prep school days, the low point of which was when my then history teacher, when handing back homework, said in front of the entire class, "Timmy, I know you're dyslexic, but I do think it's time you learnt to spell your own name correctly." So thank you to Bryanston for teaching me that, as well as many other things. I imagine that most of you are fairly familiar with the broad contours of the period and of the policy of appeasement. And so what I thought might be useful to start off is just to say how I came to write this and what I thought could be written about it that is different to what is out there already. And the genesis for this book came when I was reading some of the diaries of the National Labour MP Harold Nicholson, diaries which I'm sure many of you have read yourselves. And one particular entry leapt out of the page at me, and that is from May 1938, 2 months after Hitler had invaded Austria, and the Labour MP is walking down St. James's, and he enters a gentleman's club. And in this gentleman's club, he comes across three peers, three lords, who admit that they would rather see Hitler in London than a Labour government. And I was so shocked by this, I wanted to try and find out quite how widespread support was for the Third Reich among the British social political elite, and what, if any, effect this had on foreign policy. And so for this, I feel incredibly privileged that for my book, I was able to go to a number of previously closed sources, including those of the Duke of Buccleuch, who was and remains Europe's largest landowner, as well as the Duke of Westminster, Lord Craythorne, Alec Douglas Hume, etc. Because appeasement is quite a loaded term and now almost entirely a pejorative term, I thought it might just be useful to give a definition right at the start. Appeasement was the attempt by the British government and to a lesser extent the French government to avoid a Second World War by making reasonable, and I emphasize the word reasonable, concessions to Nazi Germany and to a certain extent fascist Italy. And the first thing to say about this is that the desire to avoid a Second World War was perhaps the most understandable and universal wish in history. As we all know, 16.5 million people died during the Great War, and 1 million British and Commonwealth soldiers died. And the utter horror of having to even contemplate another war on this scale, a mere 20 years after the war to end all wars, was too much for many people. And I think we could all empathize, or at least sympathize, with the protagonists of the 1930s who thought that they would do anything within their power to avoid it. The other thing to say about the fear of war is that it was not just that contemporaries feared a return to the bloodshed of the Somme and Passchendaele and Ypres. The next war, they believed, because of the advent of the aeroplane and its bombing capabilities, would lead to the complete and near instant destruction of entire cities. Churchill said that in the first week of war, 40 to 50,000 Londoners would die as a result of bombing. Now this, as we now know, was a massive exaggeration, or a massive inflationary prediction at any rate, because during the course of the entire Blitz, only 44,000 people died as a result of that bombing campaign. But it was nevertheless a very genuinely held fear, and as Harold Macmillan, who was a Tory MP during this time and later Prime Minister, said, people of the 30s thought about aerial warfare in the way that people of the 60s thought about nuclear warfare. And I think that's very important to bear in mind, because the decision of whether or not to go to peace or, of peace or war is always the most highly charged and important decision any political leader could ever have to make. But uniquely at a time when you believe that your own civilian population could be decimated makes it all the more potent, I think. The next thing to say is that right from the beginning, a number of people underestimated Adolf Hitler. When he came to power in January 1933, the Daily Telegraph wondered how a man who looked so uninspiring with, quote, that ridiculous little moustache, could prove so attractive to the German people, while the Labour Daily Herald scoffed at the, quote, stubby little Austrian with a flabby handshake, shifty brown eyes, and a Charlie Chaplin moustache. Nothing, continued the Herald, in the public career of little Adolf Hitler highly strung as a girl and vain as a matinee idol, indicates that he can escape the threat of his, the fate of his immediate predecessors. That said, the British and much of the world were deeply shocked by the speed with which Hitler established his dictatorship and began his rule of racial persecution. I think I certainly thought, and a lot of contemporaries now think, that the real horrors of the Nazi regime only became apparent later on, after Kristallnacht in November 1938, or after the liberation of the death camps. But this absolutely was not the case. The first nationwide act of persecution against the German Jews occurred in April 1933, 2 months after Hitler had come to power, and this was a boycott organized by Goebbels against all Jewish shops and businesses. And this was seriously reported and caused absolute uproar in this country and further afield. There were mass protests in Hyde Park and also in Manchester, Leeds, and Glasgow. And lots of people, and in fact it was carried out in the United States, that there was a reciprocal boycott of German goods. It's also important to note that there were people who from the very beginning understood the extreme danger that Adolf Hitler posed to the security of and peace of Europe. This man, who was described as being as English as eggs and bacon and was Britain's first ambassador to Nazi Germany, he'd been there since the mid-1920s, is called Sir Horace Rumbold. And he warned in a masterly 5,000-word dispatch from June 1933 that the Hitler government would pursue the policy as set out in Mein Kampf, whereby, having established a quasi-racial utopia at home, Hitler would export his gross theory of social Darwinism, that the state must continue to fight for its survival, and that superior races must continue to fight and expand their boundaries. And Hitler is incredibly explicit in Mein Kampf about where this expansion would occur. It would occur in Eastern Europe and on the plains of Russia, where he would find Lebensraum, living space, for the German population. And the precursor of that was the annihilation. Hitler uses the word annihilation of France. And this book was published in 1923, and there were various translations of it in diplomatic dispatches which the Foreign Office had. So people could not say that they had not been warned. Rumbold's a bit of a hero of mine, even though he was only ambassador for a short time because he retired in July 1933. But I love the story that later on, when he had retired, and he was at a dinner party in London, and he met an incredibly vicious, rather mean and spiteful, reactionary conservative MP. And after the Tory MP had left the dinner, Rumbold said to the assembly, "He's quite the nastiest man I've ever met in my life, and I met Hitler." This man, far more famous, obviously also warned about the Nazi danger, and Winston Churchill was warning even before Hitler came to power. Churchill ridiculed the idea that all that Hitler was after was equality of status with the other great powers. He said that this man was after Napoleonic conquest, essentially, and that the way that Britain had to protect against this threat was to build an air force which was capable of deterring or at least defeating any German force which could be meted out against it. But Churchill, for much of the 1930s, was ignored, and he was ignored for some very good reasons. This isn't a talk about Churchill, and I'm sure you all know a huge amount about him, but a man who had changed parties not once but twice, had been catastrophically wrong or seemed to be wrong about the Gallipoli disaster, the gold standard, Indian independence, the abdication, the list goes on. He was widely distrusted for what seems to many people a number of good reasons, and it's only by the fact that he was proved so comprehensively right about this one and most important challenge that Britain faced that he was able to be elevated to the premiership. Specifically, he was ignored in his request for a larger German air force, for a larger British air force with which to deter the Germans, because Britain was suffering in the 1930s from the effects of the Great Depression, mass unemployment, and frankly, nobody wanted to spend money on guns when there was a desperate shortage of butter. The other reason is the spirit of pacifism, which had grown up in Britain since the end of the Great War, and which was particularly prevalent in the years 1928 to 1933. I think it's very hard to measure public opinion at a time when opinion polls only began in 1937, but I think the reason that as much as you can say that pacifism increased in these years was the publication of so many works, which we still see to this day, All Quiet on the Western Front, by Eric Remarque, Robert Graves's Goodbye to All That, Siegfried Fassoon's Memoirs of an Infantry Officer. All of these works on stage and screen and in book form brought home to a generation who had been lucky enough to avoid the horrors of the trenches exactly what it was like. And the supreme expression of pacifism was conveyed when the Oxford Union in February 1933 passed the motion that this house will under no circumstances fight for its king and its country. And that was deeply, deeply shocking and was reported across the world. And both Mussolini and Hitler mentioned the Oxford motion as evidence of British degeneracy. The British were going soft. These were the future rulers of empire, and this was a fairly shocking symptom of the times. It also should be said that it was the official policy of the Labour Party. The Labour Party is often not talked about nearly so much as the Conservative Party because they were out of power during the 1930s. But this man was George Lansbury, the leader of the Labour Party up until 1935, who, in more than one ways, I think, bears a passing resemblance to his 21st century successor. And one of the reasons in which Lansbury is not too dissimilar to Mr. Corbyn is that Lansbury stated 10 months after Hitler came to power that his policy was to abandon the army and dismiss the Air Force. He would abolish the whole dreadful equipment of war, he said, and dare the world to do your worst. And at the Labour conference of 1933, the Labour Party voted for a motion which would lead to a general strike in the event of war, which would cripple the economy and bring down the government. And it didn't actually also change when Clement Attlee took over. The Labour Party, although very anti-fascist for most of the period, consistently voted against every single measure of rearmament during the 1930s, up to and including the introduction of conscription in the summer of 1939. The other reason that appeasement had great support is many people thought that it had a point, that Adolf Hitler had a point. The Treaty of Versailles, as you can see, the peace conference of 1919 occurring here in the Hall of Mirrors, was widely discredited by the early 30s. A treaty which, so the Germans claimed, had amputated parts of its territory for the benefit of new nations like Czechoslovakia and the reconstructed Poland, confiscated their colonies and reduced the German armed forces to a mere token force, was deeply unfair and humiliating to their amour propre. And there was a curious logic that came out of this, which was that the appeasers thought that, well, if this is the grievance, and if this is the grievance on which Nazism has prospered, then surely if we can simply redress this grievance, or in another word, appease this grievance, then there's no reason why we can't settle down for another 20 years of peace. And at this point, it's perhaps important to say that appeasement was in no way a dirty word as it is now. The first use of the term I found in relation to Germany in its post-war form comes from 1919, when the Liberal Minister Hal Fischer said that, effectively, this treaty at Versailles is not perfect, but hopefully it can be adjusted over time. And then Europe will get that period of appeasement which it needs. And people freely described themselves as appeasers right up to the summer of 1939, and it had no negative connotations whatsoever. This is a man called Lord Lothian, who was a Liberal minister, but he wasn't a minister in the 1930s, and had been with Lloyd George at the peace conference. And you can see him reading Mein Kampf there. It didn't do him much good. He was wrong about most things. But Lothian took this idea of this logical extension of appeasement to extremes. He really believed that if the Germans could purely be given equality of status with the other great powers, then there was no need for any further tensions. And he went and met Hitler several times between 1933 and 1936. The reason I mention Lothian, and by the way, I should say every time he met Hitler, he then came back to Britain and declared, almost a la Chamberlain, that there was absolutely no way that this man ever, ever wanted a war, and that he would be the last man to ever be leading Europe into a conflict. The reason I mention Lothian is he had absolutely no official accreditation whatsoever, or even encouragement. And it's this extraordinary thing which I've really tried to focus on in my book, if people occasionally ask what I've tried to do differently, is this phenomenon of the amateur diplomats. I'm very happy to take suggestions from the audience, but I can't think of another period in history when people who are well-born but otherwise essentially random, went out and conducted diplomacy on the fringes of an official diplomacy going on. And Lothian was one such figure. There were others. There was Lord Londonderry, who went out. Lloyd George went out. A number of Tory MPs. A merchant banker called Ernest Tennant started acting as a sort of unofficial travel agent for the regime. And Tennant, like other people who I think you will have heard of, such as the Mitford sisters, very much got caught up in being hugely impressed with what Hitler had achieved in his few years in power. In Britain, unemployment remained stubbornly high well into 1937, 1938, but within a few years, Hitler had halved and then eradicated it. What people didn't realize is that he had managed to do this because all of the people who had been unemployed were now working in arms factories, so that wasn't so readily appreciated. But people were terribly impressed at this sort of miracle cure. This nation, which had been on its knees and suffering hyperinflation in the 1920s, was now marching tall. And an awful lot of British visitors went to the Nuremberg rally, and I just quote from a letter that Tennant wrote to Lord Mount Temple, who was the chairman of the Anglo-German Fellowship, in 1935, after visiting this rally. And I think this picture rather conveys the sort of emotions that Tennant had. "None of the great war kings of the past, from Xerxes to the Kaiser, ever dreamt of such pomp and pageantry as Hitler's organizers at Nuremberg have made a matter of annual routine. What I saw at Nuremberg has altered none of my opinions about the steady progress of Germany and the vital importance of Anglo-German friendship. Possibly, if the present regime survives, we are witnessing the birth of a super race." And there were official attempts to try and find some sort of modus vivendi with the Nazi state. This is Sir John Simon, the bald man here, and a young Anthony Eden, who was his deputy, on his right. Sir John Simon, possibly the worst foreign secretary in British history, until slightly more recent incumbents. And this was a really farcical attempt by the British to pin Hitler down to an arms agreement and get him to guarantee his eastern border. The Treaty of Locarno from 1925 had guaranteed Germany's western border, but there were no such treaties whereby Germany had willingly agreed to abide by her eastern boundaries. Needless to say, it went nowhere, and the only moment of détente, as it were, came about at the grand dinner after this photograph was taken, and Eden and Hitler were sitting opposite each other. And it transpired that they had both been exactly opposite each other in 1918 in the last German offensive of the First World War. They had both been soldiers in the First World War, and they both drew a map on the back of a napkin and signed it. And afterwards, the French minister came rushing up to Eden and said, Minister, is it true that you were really opposite Hitler in 1918? And Eden said that it appeared to be so. And you missed him? He said, you deserve to be shot for that. So there was no modus vivendi, and instead the British were confronted by a series of coups, the most famous of which occurred in March 1936, when Hitler massively gambled and marched into the demilitarized Rhineland, right? The Rhineland, that highly industrialized area of northwest Germany on the French-Belgian border. And the reason it had been demilitarized was because this was the route through which a French army would march if they needed to officiate regime change, because the Germans were breaking up the Treaty of Versailles and once again posing a danger to Europe. And most historians, and I completely agree with them, would agree that this is the last moment that Hitler could have been stopped without a major war. So why wasn't he? Why did the British and French not stop him? Only 20,000 German troops crossed onto the west bank of the Rhine, facing a million-strong French army. And there they were under orders to fight a fighting retreat. Essentially, they could have easily been pushed out. But French politics was a shambles throughout this period. If you think that we're living through a period of political instability at the moment, I invite you to take comfort from Third Republican France, where there were no fewer than 11 prime ministers between 1930 and 1939, and governments lasted on average 4 months. and with impeccable timing, at the moment that Hitler marches into the Rhineland, there is a mere caretaker government in Paris. And the French general staff are incredibly defeatist and think that they are no match for these 20,000 poorly equipped German soldiers. In Britain, it's slightly different. The reason that we don't intervene is there is simply not a casus belli. We are a democracy, and to fight a major power, we must have the support of the populace and sense that we are fighting for just reasons, and to kick the Germans out of their own territory is simply not feasible. And this point is very clearly brought back to Anthony Eden when he asks his taxi driver what he thinks of the crisis, and his taxi driver replies, "Well, I suppose Jerry can do what he likes in his own back garden." The pace of the story slightly changes when this man becomes Prime Minister. I really wish that the Conservative leadership contenders could pose for photographs like this today. One of the best things about Neville Chamberlain was he was a passionate fisherman. And Neville Chamberlain, one of our oldest Prime Ministers, becomes Prime Minister in May 1937 at the age of 68. And he thinks that British foreign policy has been all wrong. It's been desultory and it's been reactionary. It has been simply waiting for the latest fascist coups and then reacting, or in fact not really reacting. His idea is quite radical. He thinks that what we should do is we should engage with the Germans up front. We should go and run through them. He even uses the term, with a pencil and paper, all of their demands and all of their grievances, and say, yes, you can have that, no, you can't have that, we might be able to come to an agreement here. He also believes, and this is really key to his policy, but also his undoing, that a very personal approach could be taken to the dictators. He wrote in a letter to his sister in January 1938, "The dictators are too often regarded as though they were entirely inhuman. I believe this idea to be quite erroneous. It is indeed the human side of the dictators which makes them dangerous, but on the other hand, it is the side on which they can be approached with the greatest hope of successful issue." Not everyone agreed with him. Lord Hugh Cecil, a conservative grandee, said that trying to come to agreement with the Nazis was like scratching a crocodile's nose in the hope of making it purr. While the First Lord of the Admiralty, Alfred Duff Cooper, likened Chamberlain's mission to come to terms with Hitler as akin to Little Lord Fauntleroy trying to reach a satisfactory agreement with Al Capone. But Chamberlain was determined to try and began immediately by sending his closest parliamentary associate, Lord Halifax, to Germany in November 1937 to meet Hitler at the Berghof in Berchtesgaden. Unbelievably, this summit almost got off to the most appalling start imaginable when Halifax arrived at the bottom of these steps that you can sort of see here and failed to recognize Hitler. I found this completely astonishing, and so I had to double-check this several times. Hitler, easily the most famous man in the world in 1937, and you are the Deputy Foreign Secretary. How could you, sort of a Boris Johnson-esque move? And but Halifax writes in his own account, he said, "Well, I was in the car, and I was at a low level, and I naturally assumed that this fellow in rather naff black trousers was a footman." And he starts getting out of the car and trying to offer Hitler his hat and coat before the before the German foreign minister, this man here, von Neurath, hisses in his ear, "Der Führer, der Führer!" And anyway, Hitler didn't seem to notice. But this meeting is important. It's important not because of anything that the British or Halifax manages to achieve, but because of the message that Halifax gives. Halifax is told emphatically by his boss at the Foreign Office, Anthony Eden, and the whole Foreign Office opinion, and by the permanent Undersecretary of the Foreign Office, Sir Robert van Sittart, that he is to warn Hitler that if Hitler pursues an aggressive policy with respect to Austria or to Czechoslovakia, then this will have grave consequences for the peace of Europe and Great Britain may become involved. That was what he was told to do. Halifax, in connivance with Chamberlain and the then ambassador to Germany, Sir Neville Henderson, does the complete opposite. He tells Hitler that the British have no desire to stand for the status quo, but are perfectly happy to see the Germans take over Austria and incorporate the Sudeten Germans of Czechoslovakia into the Reich, provided it is done peacefully. And Halifax really is a proper appeaser. I mean, much more, there's at this stage, there's a certain slight amorality about his attitude. In a letter to Baldwin, Stanley Baldwin, who had just stepped down as Prime Minister just before he leaves, he admits that he could in no way, despite being a devout Anglo-Catholic, bring himself to condemn either nationalism or racialism. He thought that these were perfectly fine. And then he said, he goes on in his letter, "I cannot myself doubt that these fellows are genuine haters of communism. And I dare say that if we were in their position, we would do exactly the same." Hitler naturally takes this as a sign of weakness, and it is not long before he has indeed taken his next step on the road to war and the German army has entered Austria. And here you can see him addressing delirious crowds in Vienna's Heldenplatz, Heroes Square, in March 1938. Once the Germans are in Austria, there's no chance of a war over this. The Austrians, as you can see here, seem to welcome Hitler. They greet him with flowers rather than machine guns. And there's absolutely nothing that the British and French, the French, by the way, who are typically without a government again for the weekend, there's nothing that the British and French could do to get them out. But it does concentrate minds. People start saying, when is this guy going to stop? When are we going to take a stand? Or is he just going to go on and on? Because Hitler had promised that he had no interest in Austria, just as he had promised beforehand to respect the Treaty of Locarno, which guaranteed the demilitarized zone in the Rhineland. And people like Leo Amery, the former colonial secretary and senior conservative MP, wrote in his diary immediately afterwards that this latest German coup means facing realities. And I now think that the best hope of peace is in telling Germany that if she touches Czechoslovakia, then we are in it too. That was one view, and it was Churchill's view, but it was not everybody's view. A conservative MP called George Tryon, who later became Lord Tryon and owned an estate up the Woodford Valley, said that he thought it was ridiculous to guarantee a country that we could neither get at nor spell. And in that, I think he was probably right. An awful lot of people did not know how to spell Czechoslovakia. And not that I, as someone who's very bad at spelling, hold that against them myself, but it was slightly odd as the time went on. And then there was this extraordinary, one of the most revealing set of letters I came across was written by a totally unknown, very undistinguished, well, I don't say he might have been distinguished in certain ways, but in this episode, not particularly distinguished, conservative MP called Michael Beaumont, who was a conservative member for Aylesbury. And he wrote a letter immediately after Austria to the Under Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, Rab Butler. And I think it's worth quoting just to give you a sense of the unwillingness of many people in Britain, and particularly within the Conservative Party, to fight for Czechoslovakia. "For God's sake, do what you can to stop the country being stampeded by hysteria over this most unpleasant business into entering into any more foreign commitments, particularly with regard to Czechoslovakia. Quite apart from people like me who would sooner be tortured at the stake than fight for that beastly country, there are more of us than you might think. I am quite sure that while the bulk of the country now is shocked over Austria that is prepared to do anything, the old unwillingness to risk their lives for anything in which we are not directly concerned will quickly revive." I'm also just going to give you, because it's my favorite letter in the book, another quotation from Beaumont. In the height of the Czech crisis, when people were digging trenches in Hyde Park and trying on gas masks and thinking that the new Armageddon was about to occur, Beaumont, I mean, it really was absolutely at the moment where everyone was panicking, particularly in the Foreign Office. Beaumont wrote again to Rab Butler, who was the Deputy Foreign Secretary, and begins in just such a wonderfully English manner. "Dear Rab, I realize that you're neither in the right time or place to receive shooting invitations. But if we are not all submerged in Holocaust, can you come and shoot here on 17th of December, arriving on the 16th and staying for the weekend? Whatever you do, keep us out of war long enough to shoot with you in December. Damn the Czechs." I don't know how well you can see this map at the back, but in essence, the Czech crisis was all about this area of Czechoslovakia known as the Sudetenland, which housed 3.25 million ethnic Germans, which had never been part of Bismarck's Germany, never part of modern Germany. They had been previously subjects of the Austro-Habsburgs, but who now, under a sort of proto-Hitler called Konrad Heinlein, were being whipped up into a hysteria to join with the Reich, or at any rate, achieve self-determination within the Czech state. And for people like Halifax and Chamberlain, this was totally fine, and they had a point. this area of Europe has never been a traditional British concern. A maritime and imperial power, we were, had a far-flung empire which we were hardly able to keep together at the time anyway. Why on earth were we going to go and risk a world war which could result in the complete loss of that empire for a load of dam checks, as Michael Beaumont described them, in a faraway country, as Chamberlain famously said? Well, Churchill's answer to that was very simple, is that there was another, much older principle of British foreign policy which held true, and that is to stop any one power from dominating the continent. And that is why we had opposed the ambitions of Louis XIV in the 17th century, why we opposed the ambitions of Napoleon, why we opposed the ambitions of the Kaiser, and why we eventually went to war with Hitler in 1939. Chamberlain, however, doesn't credit Hitler with this idea for Napoleonic conquest. He's absolutely convinced that Hitler is telling the truth when he says that all he wants is the Sudetendeutsch to join the Reich. And beyond that, he also has a plan. And that is that at the last moment, he will fly to Hitler in what was an incredibly dramatic gesture. Now, we're very used to politicians jumping in airplanes for summits at which not much happens the whole time. But this was, at the 11th hour, a 69-year-old man who had never been on a long-haul flight before, flying off to visit Hitler in Berchtesgaden. And at this meeting, which you can see here, and now you will understand why this tablecloth is here on the table. This is really rather amazing. This has been lent to the History Festival for this, and you should come up and have a look at it. This is the tablecloth that Hitler had, and that you can see not very well in that photograph that he had at Berchtesgaden. And the stories that the tablecloth could tell are that at this meeting, Chamberlain essentially surrendered everything that Hitler had demanded by saying that it was perfectly fine for the Sudetendeutsch to have self-determination, provided it was done peacefully. He had no problem, he wrote to his sister. In fact, worse than no problem, he said, I personally don't give two hoots whether the Sudeten Germans join with the Reich or not. My main concern was to avoid war. He also believes Hitler. He believes Hitler that this is all he wants, and he believes Hitler when he says that this is a binding agreement between statesmen. And this is a moment where his vanity as a politician starts to undo him. He leaves the meeting and immediately starts bragging to people about how he had really negotiated very well with Hitler, whereas Hitler started teasing Chamberlain behind his back with Eva Braun, this funny old man with an umbrella. The Germans were absolutely astonished by an umbrella. The junior German diplomat said at the time, we just could not believe that a man looking like this could be the Prime Minister of Great Britain. Could get more extraordinary yet. But Chamberlain then, along with the French, managed to coerce the Czechs, who were allies of the French and allies of the Soviet Union, into surrendering the Sudetenland. And here you can see Chamberlain returning to Germany. He didn't visit Hitler once. He visited Hitler three times. This is the second time at Bad Godesberg on the Rhine. And he's come back. He's looking incredibly pleased with himself because he was. He had got the Czechs to agree, the Czechs who said they would fight, the Czechs who had a 30-division, very strong, highly motivated army, the largest munitions works in the world, an incredibly sophisticated defense system along the German border. He had got them to agree to the surrender of the Sudetenland. But Hitler is not interested in a peaceful solution and so turns it down. Hitler wants to take over the whole of Czechoslovakia, and so he makes all sorts of difficulties and says that the German occupation must happen immediately, and we must also think about the other minorities that are housed within this nation, the Slovaks, the Poles, the Hungarians. And at this point, it really does seem that a war is about to occur because the cabinet revolt. Halifax, previously the leading appeaser, even more of an appeaser than Neville Chamberlain, has a sleepless night in about the 25th of September, 1938. He has a sleepless night and suddenly decides, I can't do this anymore. He says at the cabinet meeting the next day, I cannot get away from the fact that Hitler is demanding everything at gunpoint. He is not making any concessions towards us. He's acting like he's won a war already, and I have a profound conviction that if we give in now, he will simply be back for more. Chamberlain is shocked, but it's not as much as the rest of the world is. And here you can see people digging trenches in Hyde Park as they expected the bombing campaign to occur. It doesn't occur because at the last moment, as we know, Hitler called a summit at Munich, at which essentially the main demands that he had made both at Berchtesgaden and Godesberg were agreed to. The Munich Agreement had been decided beforehand. It wasn't a terribly exciting conference. It was exciting for the sort of farcical elements of it, like the fact that the German efficiency completely broke down and there was no ink or paper or working telephones or any of the apparatus that you needed for a major international summit. But nevertheless, most of the major decisions had been made beforehand. And I just want to finish by talking about this agreement, which was, and I think remains, the most controversial agreement that the world has ever made, and is continually cited now when anybody tries to make a deal with a former power, be it Iran or North Korea. The Munich Agreement and appeasement is always brought up time and time again. That it was a disaster for the Czechs, I don't think is possible to deny. The Czechs lost 800,000 of their own civilians and all of their fortifications and all of their natural resources, and really did become a vassal state at the mercy of Nazi Germany. The traditional defense of appeasement was that it gave this country and France vital time in which to rearm. And there is something to be said for that. The Spitfires and Hurricanes and radar, all of which made the difference between victory and defeat in the Battle of Britain, were not ready in September 1938, but were ready in September 1939. What this argument ignores, however, is the fact that the Germans were in no position to wage a long-range strategic bombing campaign in September 1938. As the war showed, they had to first invade and conquer their neighbors and secure airfields along the Channel coast. And secondly, this so-called breathing space was enjoyed by the Germans as well. And if you look at the figures, you can see that the Germans actually outarmed the British in the air and on land between 1938 and 1939. So I do not think that the breathing space argument really holds much water. And finally, this was the last chance for the West to bind other powers, most importantly the Soviet Union, into a grand alliance which could have either deterred Hitler or defeated him should war come as swiftly as possible. We all know now that it was the Russians who ultimately paid the blood price for the defeat of Nazi Germany. And although the regime under Joseph Stalin was even more insidious than that presided over by Adolf Hitler, it was a basic fact that we required the Russians to defeat the Germans, and they had been offering continually for the last 2 years to come into some sort of anti-fascist bloc. But due to the enormous suspicion of communism, the British had always cold-shouldered them. And the only final thing I'll say, but I won't go into it now because I'd like to take your questions, is that appeasement didn't stop here. And that's why I've tried my book to go all the way up to June 1940. There were officially no major attempts at appeasement once Hitler broke the Munich Agreement and marched into Czechoslovakia, the whole of Czechoslovakia, in March 1939. But there were numerous covert attempts, even some after the outbreak of war. And that is something which I think not that many people are aware of, but may have to be discussed in greater length at another occasion. Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.